And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Englehart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We'd like to thank everybody that contributed during our one-day fundraiser last week. And if you didn't get a chance to contribute then, you can always go to WMNF.org and put something in the tip jar. We hope you'll put it in for From a Woman's Point of View. But whatever, it goes to the station, and just think where we would be in this community without WMNF. It perhaps is our greatest treasure.
Media, independent media is a rare, rare thing. I just heard the latest news, and I'm not at all surprised. My first guest, Teresa Lau, she's with the National Women's Law Center, and we are going to be talking about Amy Coney Barrett and really, to me, the profound challenges and dangers I really feel that she represents to so many areas of our lives. In fact, out of some of the achievements we tried to do for people, not only women's reproductive rights and their autonomy, but labor rights, union rights, economic rights, across the board. I think when you get into people really who think that they can divine the meaning of the original writers of the Constitution, you're getting into some pretty touchy-feely areas there, and it's awfully hard not to come down to a matter of, this is the way I see it, and I am of the prophetic Tory part. But anyway, but I am excited about this show. As I just already said, we're going to be talking to Teresa Lau from the National Women's Law Center, and I'm real curious to know what they're thinking and how they're going to progress now. But also then I was able to catch up with Aaron Balkin from Take Back the Courts. He already has decided that she is going to be confirmed. He doesn't see any way to stop it. But what can we do then to actually address the serious problems, really, of the judiciary, of which we have no control over in terms of votes, etc.? How do we handle this? And so it's really problematic times, but very challenging. Democracy was never promised to be easy, and it is worth the challenge. And I really feel right now that we are fighting really for the democracy and the future of this country, not only for your children, your grandchildren, but for the seventh generation down the line. So anyway, I am excited about this show. So I'm going to put this music on because, as Laura Love always said, sometimes Davy wins. I'm not sure who Davy is anymore because Trump wants us to feel that he is Davy. He is the oppressed one. He is the underdog. I'm not really quite sure anybody is an underdog right now. I don't really know where things stand. So anyway, let's put this on by Laura Love, and then we will come back with Teresa Lau.
Guy was big and really big. In fact, he was a giant. It was smaller, much by far, but not quite microscopic. His name was Davy, the short one. The big guy was Goliath. I don't read the Bible much. In fact, it's more like never. But I still think it's really cool that Davy kicked his butt. Sometimes Davy wins. 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 The real estate executive called you to the home office. What a place, what a really great place. Eureka, we struck gold. All the people gathered round, they yelled, you gotta go, son. We do not need your Wally World. In fact, we can be no fun. Take your big fat assets to another piece of ground. Sometimes
Davy wins. Sometimes Davy wins, right? but Davey's got a lot of work to do right now, so I'm going to pod this music down because I am so happy that we do have our guest on the line. With us, we have Teresa Lau, and she's with the National Women's Law Center. She is in charge of, or she's senior counsel, actually, for reproductive rights and the courts. So, Teresa Lau, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary. I appreciate you reaching out.
Well, I'm sure you've followed the news today that they actually, Graham, voted it out of committee, even though all the Democrats boycotted it. And as I understand it, legally, doesn't there have to be two representatives there for it to count? And so do you think that then this will go to the parliamentarian? In other words, before we get into Amy Coney Barrett, because I really think we do need to be aware of some of the real threats I think she presents to some of the most not just progressive, but necessary advantages for people in this country that have been passed over the years. Do you think that's going to go to the parliamentarian? How are you seeing that?
Well, I will say, obviously, I share your same outrage about what happened this morning, about how the Republicans and the Senate Judiciary Committee voted out this nominee, so it's a committee rule. It's a committee rule that at least two members of the minority party have to be present in order to continue with business. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all, because if you were paying attention last week, Senator Graham did the same thing and broke this rule again and continued to move forward Amy Coney Barrett's nomination. And so, sadly, I don't think that there is going to be, the parliamentary is going to come in and be able to stop the movement. I think part of it is the committee rule, and Graham broke that rule. And I think this is really just another example of how ridiculous this process is and has been, and how there's a clear agenda in terms of why the Republicans are pushing forward this nominee at this time. You know, when we're, 2 weeks away from the election?
Yeah, and as I, now I don't know, maybe this isn't the schedule, but what I was reading last night is that actually then they're hoping to have a vote for confirmation on Monday.
Yes, that is what we're hearing. And, you know, based on the timing of everything, they could have a final confirmation vote as soon as Monday evening.
And Teresa, you're talking to me. Here we are in Florida. And Florida is one of the really important states. It's going to be really very, very important in this election. And here I am looking and thinking back to, you know, Bush versus Gore. And when Catherine Harris was Secretary of State, that she managed to disqualify 98,000 votes, and she said that they were felons, and not a one of them were felons. But three individuals who were very much involved down here with our hanging chads and all the problems were Neil Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Amy Barrett. And there we've got two. We've got Gorsuch and we've got Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. And Amy Barrett is being pushed through at absolutely lightning speed. I think that's really a pretty sad kind of anecdote of history.
Absolutely. I think sometimes I think about what's happening in the past month, and it really does boggle the mind, right? I think this confirmation process has taken a little bit over 30 days, basically, between when Justice Ginsburg passed away and then within a week, the president nominated somebody, and then they rammed through a confirmation hearing less than 45 days away from an election. So I think this is never in the history of this country has this happened, where there's been a confirmation of a Supreme Court justice this close to an election year, and especially since, you know, as you know, there have been millions of people have already voted, right?
Mm-hmm. About
100, I think it's over 100 million is the number I've seen so far. Over 100 million people have already cast their ballot for the election, and yet we're still going to ram through a nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, who, you know, in her own right is a really problematic candidate, which we can absolutely talk about more, but I think just like in this current moment where the country is barely surviving the pandemic and like people have already voted, I think that it's really just a truly a outrage and just a very shocking shocking time in our history.
Well, and you know that legalese, I mean, I think that, and thinking back to the great RBG, and she really earned her notorious RBG moniker.
Definitely.
But the really important part of her is that she realized from the get-go that she had to kind of educate, she had to kind of bring up to snuff her fellow colleagues on the court, because they were men, of course, and they really didn't understand, you know, some of the issues. They didn't understand it except from a male point of view. And so from the get-go, we were aware that they are human beings and that their living experience, their beliefs, their philosophies are going to come into play with their decisions, no matter how the law is written, that any word can be looked at 10 sides over. And this is a part, to me, and I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but to me, that's a necessary part of the legal procedure, because, you know, way back when the Constitution was written, I mean, sex wasn't mentioned at all in the court, and yet you'd in the Constitution, as I understand it, and yet you certainly, you see it all the time being interpreted.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think you make such a great point about, you know, the late RBG. Like, part of the reason why she became a cultural icon and why she is such an important figure for women and for women's rights is that she really brought in the lived experiences of people. I think that you can't, you know, you can't just look at the law in a vacuum. You have to really see, like, what the impact is, you know, whether someone is facing difficulties to be able to put forward a legal issue. Like, you know, I think that there are all these pieces that she looked at and that she lifted up in her dissent, in her opinions, whereas I think one of the troubling things about this nominee of Amy Coney Barrett, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that she is, you know, a self-proclaimed originalist, and she also has said that, like, Justice Scalia's judicial philosophy is her own, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those are just extremely troubling viewpoints if you think about what originalism oftentimes is one of the viewpoints that it is very grounded on kind of what, but I like to say, like, really dismisses the lived experiences of, like, real life people. You know, if you're trying to bring things back to the days when, you know, only white men held power, I feel like it becomes a really scary thought to think about somebody on the court who could be on, you know, this is a lifetime appointment. So we're talking about someone who is 48 who could be in the court. If she lives as long as RBG did, for 40 years, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. So you have somebody who could be on the court for 40 years putting out decisions that impact everyday people's everyday lives.
And actually, with Scalia and with RBG's friendship with Scalia, and how they both loved opera, over-the-top opera, that makes sense to me, that Supreme Court justices would like opera, to tell you the truth. But I honestly felt that, because I've learned more about judicial decisions and their ramifications doing this show than I ever expected to learn, that I really felt Scalia was more of a human being than what I am seeing so far of Amy Coney Barrett. There is an aspect to her writing, not just some of the decisions she's made on the Seventh Circuit Court, but some of her writing that I really find so chillingly cold that it really, there's something about that really almost scares me, really, to have this kind of an individual, I don't care if it's a man or a woman, on the Supreme mm-hmm. Court.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is, you know, I think if you listen to the hearings, I feel like oftentimes, you know, Amy Coney Barrett had said something along the lines of, like, you know, I have my personal beliefs, but that won't affect my decision making. And I think, you know, it does matter, right? Like, I'm assuming you're referring to sort of like the ads that came out in the last couple of weeks, where she signed on to an ad that, for example, talked about how Roe, you know, the fundamental decision that gave the right access to abortion, where she signed on an ad that said, like, Roe was barbaric, it's an exercise of raw judicial power, that it should end. I mean, she didn't, there was another ad where she signed on where she, you know, falsely talked about how, you know, 55 million unborn children have been killed by abortions, and really trying to talk about protecting the unborn. Like, those. And I think that those pieces that came out, first of all, she didn't disclose them to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Like, you know, this was broken by reporters. Second of all, like, the statements that she signed on to are extremely troubling, right? I think that they really show a they show kind of what her judicial philosophy would be, and it really, you know, and I think that those really extreme beliefs have translated into some of her decision making.
And you know, again, we're talking to Teresa Lau, and she's with the National Women's Law Center. I guess I kind of expect a lawyer to be prompt. I also expect them to dot the I's and cross the T's. And so when you were supposed to put, you know, all the materials that related, you know, to your their consideration of you on the court, I would expect that to have been done very early and in due process. And yet, just yesterday, I was reading that I did not realize that her father worked for Shell Oil and also was a member of the American Petroleum Institute, and yet she feels that climate change, that she can't really give an opinion about that. And you know, to me, climate change is really probably even a bigger existential threat right now than even Barrett and Trump are. And so to me, you know, I expect either more honesty from a judge than that, or more intelligence, or more awareness of the society she lives in. And I really found that really troubling.
I did too. I mean, I think that, you know, when you listen to the hearing and sort of the questions she was asked and how she didn't answer them, like, I think the basic question is climate change real? And she dodged it.
Yeah.
I think she was always saying, like, these are issues of policy, or, like, these are controversial issues. And, you know, one of the questions that was also pretty telling was, I think Senator Booker asked, like, do you think it is right to separate children from their parents as a way to deter immigration? And she, again, dodged it and couldn't say yes or no. And I think that that was kind of the whole, if you notice in the hearing, and like when people are asking her questions about, you know, do you think that, you know, do you think the Constitution will protect people who want to get IVF? And again, she doesn't answer these questions. And I think that these are important questions that people deserve to know, and she should be forthright about it. And she should, I think that there are, you know, clear answers that she should be able to give.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one of the most egregious things we've had in this country in the last few years has been the separation of children from their parents. You know, people that this is a nation of immigrants. And, you know, so many of the activities down in South and in Central America, et cetera, are kind of connected to our foreign policy. So if anything, we bear some responsibility for an awful lot of these immigrants coming. And really, I am very troubled. I want to know, where are those children, and why in heaven name hasn't there been really very carefully, you know, kept records? I mean, this is a really, really serious problem. And to somehow just be so, to be so dismissive of that, you know, to me, this is a moral challenge to this country. And I was really quite angry. And my co-host here, Arlene Engelhardt, wants to say something. Go ahead, Arlene.
Well, I find it just incredible that there are 525 children right now, as that we know of, that they can't, quotes, find their parents. They assume that they were deported earlier, and they have no record of who belongs to whom. To me, that's just despicable.
And, you know, I have done this show long enough to know that There are bottomless limits to depravity, really. And this might really sound far out, but I've been reading enough that I'm really quite concerned that I want to make sure that these kids that they cannot account for, and not all of them are little babies in, say, 2 and 3 and 4, but I want to make sure that there haven't been some scandalous people who are trying to get some of these children and involve them, God forbid, in something like sex trafficking. I mean, really, I really am actually worried about that, because I've done this show long enough to know that those kind of situations can be happening. And to me, this is why it is essential that every one of those kids are accounted for, and how are they being taken care of, and what is the plan for their future, and how are they involving the parents that have probably been deported back. And I don't mean to get off on a kick on that, but that, you know, laws and what judges decide is critical to us. And there you have this rigid woman, and I'm sorry that I read this rigidity, and it's not just women's reproductive rights. Because she challenges unscientifically, you know, that birth control and methods are abortifacts. And it's right. this kind of rigidity that simply cannot stand the test what we need right now in our times. Sorry, go ahead, Teresa.
No, absolutely. No, I think that is such a, you know, I think the fact that she wouldn't say whether, so Griswold v. Connecticut, which is sort of the case about protects the right to birth control, she wouldn't commit to saying that this was correctly decided. This is a long-standing case. The impacts are important, right? Because this case is all about, like, the right to privacy, the right. And, like, I think that something about her record, as you just pointed out, is she has pretty much denied science in that factor, right? Like, she signed onto a letter that basically mischaracterized what birth control is. And I think that is extremely troubling, and it really just shows how her extreme views can impact her decision-making if she becomes a Supreme Court justice.
And to me, one of the really important pillars of this country has been separation of church and state. I think Europe had enough experiences of all kinds of problems with that. And I am very troubled by anybody that says that whatever your career law, if you practice law, it's a means to an end to bring the kingdom of God here on earth. And I find that an extraordinarily chilling statement to make. That Amy Coney Barrett has made. And to me, that really shakes right at the foundation of this country of separation of church and state, no matter what your church is.
Absolutely. I think that is some, you know, it is, like, you know, we said earlier, it's sort of troubling to think about, like, how her views can percolate into her decision making. Because, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, she can sit in front of the hearing and say, like, you know, my personal views are my own, but that won't impact my decision making. But at the same time, she has said a lot of very troubling things in her speeches, in her writings, that suggest otherwise.
Yeah,
No,
you're the expert, not me.
No, I was just gonna, you know, say that also, like, and part of the reason why people are so concerned is because there are cases in the pipeline about all these issues that she could decide, right? You know, obviously there are dozens of cases about reproductive rights that are steps away from the Supreme Court. There are cases about whether employers can use, you know, can impose their religious beliefs on their employees and deny access to birth control. There are, you know, cases about whether, you know, organizations can, again, like, whether people who are organizations that receive federal funding can use religion as a way to discriminate against people receiving benefits. You know, so there's all these cases in the pipeline that are about this issue, about, you know, whether you can use religion as an excuse to discriminate against LGBTQ people, about, you know, reproductive decisions and things like that. So it's not just, like, a, you know, theoretical. It is real.
Yeah, and the Affordable Care Act, and I believe that comes up like November 10th. You know, something as critical, really. I mean, and this to me constantly shows the evolving nature of life and society, that there will, if you've been, tested positive for COVID, and 7 million have, will that be a pre-existing condition? Now, that is going to be huge because they don't even know all what COVID does. And I mean, it's something like that. If she's that rigid not to be aware of that, I don't see how that can possibly work to be on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. And, like, yeah, you said, the Affordable Care Act is going to be in front of the Supreme Court in a couple of weeks. There's a nefarious reason why people are pushing to get her on the court so soon. So she could be sitting on this court to decide on whether the ACA is constitutional or not, right? It's also, she's there to decide whether or not this election can be invalidated. You know, there's so many pieces that are, it's sort of like a puzzle piece, right? You feel like, well, why are people pushing to have Amy Coney Barrett on this court so soon? And, you know, we know why, right?
And she slipped up a little bit on that one, I thought, because I don't remember exactly what happened, but she said, well, you can separate, you know, the individual mandate from the rest of the act, as if, in other words, if you take out the individual mandate that everybody has to have it, then you've gutted it. You've gutted it. And she kind of, I thought, slipped a little bit on that because she already was seemingly thinking ahead to that.
Right, exactly. I think, you know, she misrepresented the case in many ways, right? She kept saying, like, oh, you can separate. But the people who are pushing this case forward, they are trying to invalidate the entire ACA. That includes like protections to pre-existing conditions. That includes preventative care services. That includes like the protections for women in particular in terms of, you know, having their wellness exams covered, having like not being able to charge women more for health coverage than men. Like, I think that those are pieces that, like, I feel she ignores. She's sort of trying to say this is like a procedural issue or something that isn't actually at risk. You know what I mean? I think that that's the really troubling thing about it, is that, you know, she's misrepresenting what this case is about.
Yeah, and the cost of contraception. I mean, and particularly this will be burdensome to poorer people because I think I was reading there, it's equivalent to, you know, 1 year of pills, so to speak, is 51 hours of work. And I don't remember the other one, but I mean, you're talking significant imposition. And another area that is so important, and once again, it reflects really hard-fought, step-by-step efforts, and that's sexual harassment. Of particularly young students. And I was just reviewing that again, and I was just kind of horrified. Grade 7 to 12, you know, essentially middle school to high school. And 56% of young women, young girls there are assaulted in one way or another. And I think 18% of boys. And, you know, that was such a hard, slow process to get schools to even admit there could be such a thing as sexual assault and sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And there, she's taking the attitude that just that it is an imposition on men. And in Doe versus Purdue, I mean, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but here is a case where the young man in the case actually apologized to his girlfriend for what he did to her. And now he's suing, and there are over 600 lawsuits that are coming down. And to me, after all of the efforts and the work, and it's hardly a perfect process yet, it will be undone. And to me, that is egregious, because education is the key for everybody in this society. And you cannot deny young women the opportunity, you know, because somebody has assaulted them, or God forbid, if their professor or their teacher makes some advances to them and they drop out of school, they don't have any standing rights whatsoever. I was going through some of this and I thought, this is really, really not acceptable. It's draconian.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you for bringing up this case, because I know it hasn't gotten a lot of press or a lot of, I don't think she got any questions asked during the hearing about this. But really, as you mentioned, it's like sort of turning upside down a law that was supposed to protect students who are survivors of sexual assault. And instead, you know, in Barrett's decision, she basically makes it, you know, she believes that like when schools are taking sexual assault seriously, and you know, when a student is found guilty of sexual assault, they then are exhibiting anti-male bias against that student, as opposed, you know, so it's like the fact that schools are taking this allegation seriously is showing that instead the school is being discriminatory against men. Like, I think that's a ridiculous notion, and it really turns upside down what this law was meant to do.
And Arlene, go ahead.
Well, on a slightly unrelated area, we've had a text from Leah in Tampa asking, when do human rights begin?
Yeah. Okay, Teresa. Teresa Law from the National Women's Law Center. This is a question for you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe.
When do human rights begin? One of our listeners has texted in.
Listeners can text in. And so, you know, that she says life begins at fertilization, probably at ovulation. She probably might think it does. I don't know. I'm being in jest, of course. But this listener wonder, when do human rights begin?
I mean, I think the real question here, and I think, is really thinking about what Barrett's beliefs are on this, right? I think that, you know, we've seen kind of what she signed on to in the ads, in her writings, and in particular, like what that means for her decision making about these types of cases. So I think that's kind of what I would say in terms of, what, you know, the question is like, what does Barrett believe, right? And how she would impact that. those lines of thinking.
Yeah, and also the bare sliver she gave, you know, that with Brown versus Board of Education. And yes, she thought that that was a precedent. I mean, she likes the word super precedent. But I really was interested that she was saying that actually in terms of work employment, that actually that the employee has to go above showing that there was, quote, racial discrimination, that they have to go above that to prove that there was discrimination against them. And I thought, whoa, what is this about? You prove a Brown versus Education, and you test the fact that their cause is great, you know, harm. But yet, if you have an employment, you know, problem, you have to go beyond that. And I thought, what is this about? And I find the shaving slivers she does is really very, very troubling. Once again, it's to me, it's almost an abuse of law. To me, it's almost an abuse of legalities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's a really good point in terms of, like, I'm assuming you're referring to the workplace case where...
I think AutoZone.
AutoZone, yes, exactly, where, you know, she said that it's okay to, you know, an employer policy where they separate workers by race is okay. But despite the fact that she, during a hearing, said that she thinks that Brown v. Board of Education is correctly decided. You know, it doesn't square away, right? It's sort of like there's an inconsistency here. What inconsistency here? Like, what do you believe? And how is that going to be, you know, how does that show up in your cases? And, you know, this is a really good example of how it shows up in her cases. She doesn't think that, you know, it's sort of like, well, in this decision, she said it was okay for there to be separate and somehow separate but equal workplaces.
And so I'm looking at the clock, Teresa Lau. And what is the Women's Law Center? I mean, I'm afraid I see this going forward. And I don't know. The Democrats are supposedly going to try and stop it. But then what? Do you think there should be additional members added to the court? Have you, has the Women's Law Center come out with then beyond that? I mean, well, if she does get the seat on the court, what then?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I will say that part of the reason why we're fighting so hard against Barrett is what she represents, right? We, A, don't want her to sully the legacy of the late Justice Ginsburg, but, you know, I think that her seat should always forever be tainted. This is a stolen seat. This is an illegitimate confirmation. And, I, you know, in terms of next steps, I think it really does depend, right? It depends on the makeup of the White House, the Senate, and the House. It really, you know, there are obviously a lot of groups that are advocating for different court reform measures, whether that's term limits, whether it's adding seats to the district circuit or Supreme Court. And I think that those are pieces that I think deserve their own, like, podcast to talk about it, right? Because I think that these are complicated questions. These are sort of different measures that the legislator can take to change this. But, you know, like I said, like, we still have to, you know, I don't think the fight is lost yet. We still have until Monday. And I think from then on, it's also talking about, like, what is, you know, how can we ensure that people see why she is an illegitimate nominee for the Supreme Court?
And so people need to call their senators fiercely and make their opinions known and try and put that impression in. You're right. It's all going to come down to, you know, who's going to control Congress after the next election, which is, what, I think in 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pushing this through. And what the average time for a Supreme Court justice to be, the whole process is 70 to 80 days. And we're doing this in less than 2 weeks. So that's what the plan is, and to try and affect Congress to get the people elected that you think would carry on the fight. So, okay, Teresa Lau, National Women's Law Center, you do great work there, and so I think I'll bring you back because, unfortunately, this can't be the end of this chapter. There's too much at stake. No, I'm serious. There's too much at stake for this democracy, for this just to go forward with essentially then it'll be a 6-3 vote. You know, I mean, trouble brews. Okay, and anything else you wanted to say before I let you go?
No, absolutely. Just thank you so much for having me on the show, and I really appreciate us having a conversation about this. I think it's such an important issue, and I really hope that listeners are paying attention and, you know, acting as much as they can, and ensuring that, you know, talk to people, talk to your senators, talk to your friends, talk to your family about this. this vote, both, you know, the vote for to confirm Barrett and, you know, the different things that we can do to try to fix our democracy.
Okay, Teresa Lau, National Women's Law Center, thank you so much. You do take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Go ahead, Arlene.
Well, I was just going to say support for WMNF comes from our members and WEDU-PBS. PBS's Speaking Great documentary airs October 29th at 9 p.m. on WEDU, followed by WEDU's First Public Square, a virtual town hall series to help our community come together and support each other through these times.
Okay, well, I was able to catch up with Aaron Belkin yesterday, and he is with a group. In fact, he's the founder of Take Back the Court, and he is making. He and his group are making definite plans for if Amy Barrett is confirmed. So let's give a listen to Aaron Belkin. Trying to get the cursor. So welcome to the show, Aaron Belkin, and he is with Take Back the Court, just an absolutely essential need right now. Aaron is an activist extraordinaire. He has an extensive background working with many causes, but as we are aware right now with Amy Coney Barrett, we have serious problems. So Aaron Belkin, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Aaron, it is such a pleasure to have you because I really went to your website and spent quite a bit of time. And wow, you really go through it. And it's not just a matter of taking back the court, but it's actually stopping the kind of chicanery we've had in the Senate for the last 30 years almost, that have stopped progressive legislation and are, I think, opposed to American values. So, what are you suggesting, Aaron?
Well, my argument is that there are really a couple of emergencies. And there's been some denialism, I think, among Democrats and among progressives about our ability to face these emergencies. And our argument is that the only way to get the country back on track is to, of course, win in the election coming up in a couple of weeks, but then to expand the Supreme Court. And the short bottom line about that, let's just focus on two of the emergencies. One is climate change. You know, parts of Florida are sinking under the sea, and yet we have a court that would not allow the next administration to pass a climate change bill because the court has shown quite clearly over the last generation that when big corporate interests are before the court almost always rules in favor of the big corporate interests. And so, you know, we on the left sometimes think that, oh, if Biden wins the election and, you know, we take the Senate and the House, then we'll be able to address climate change. No, that's not the case because the court won't let us do that. But that's also true with other emergencies like voter suppression, the millions of black and brown people who are not allowed to vote today because, frankly, you know, GOP cheating and voter suppression. Well, the Supreme Court's responsible for that, too, because they destroyed the Voting Rights Act after it had been reauthorized in the Senate 98-0. And so there are just a range of really, really, I mean, planetary crises that will not be able to solve unless we expand the court.
Yeah, you know that I have been totally focused on this election, but I'm quite aware of climate change, and we are on a really short end of stick. In fact, if anything, it is more urgent, in my opinion, even than this election, but because of the exigencies of this election, it's got to start with that. And also, a really serious problem, and in this state and so many other states, is the kind of gerrymandering, where these just incredibly strange districts, and they clump an awful lot of, frankly, Democratic or voters they think might not go with them into one or two sections, and then all the rest belong to the party that they think most represents them. And this is a really serious problem also.
You know, so I'm a political science professor, and my colleagues often make things out to be more complicated than they really are. And it's actually a pretty simple story. And the story is this, from my perspective, and just kind of echoing what you just said, is that the Republicans can't win elections in a free and fair system. And they can't win elections for the simple reason that the stuff they believe in, you know, tax cuts for the rich and deregulating corporations that are out to, you know, frankly, screw all of us. The stuff that the Republicans believe in are not—it's not popular, and so they have to rig the system. That's why they've spent the last generation flooding the system with dark money and hyperpartisan gerrymandering and voter suppression and lying and stealing courts. So that's what they do. But the courts are critical to all of that, because if you had a court that was making decisions on the basis of law instead of nakedly partisan interests, then none of that cheating would be allowed to stand. But the Roberts majority on the Supreme Court is totally responsible for hyperpartisan gerrymandering that you just mentioned, is totally responsible for voter suppression, is totally responsible for flooding the system with dark money, because every time those issues come up in front of the court, Roberts and his conservative allies are like, sure, hyperpartisan gerrymandering, we love that. And Mitch McConnell knows that, which is why he stole the court in 2016. The stealing the court is a key part of what allows the GOP to cheat.
Yeah, and not only the Supreme Court, but also appellate and district courts. I mean, there Barack Obama was in office, and Mitch McConnell, who is the perfidus personified, manages to block so he can't put over 100 different judges. And you know that this happens to be the celebration of the 100th year of women getting to vote. And, you know, going through the history of that and how African-American women essentially were denied the vote until 1965. I mean, really, I mean, realistically speaking, the same kind of measures of the poll tax and all the other lynching, whatever, were applied to women, too. And so we have that scandalous history, really. And now, you know, and so then they try and say, oh, you know, I think they want, I've read about this group, Save the Nine, as if there's something sacred about the nine. And yet in the history of the Supreme Court, we have gone from what, 5 to 10? It's been changed like 5 or 6 times. Right?
Well, the number of Supreme Court justices has changed 6 times in American history, and the Constitution anticipates that Congress is allowed to change the contours of the court for precisely the reasons that we're seeing today. And I'm glad you mentioned women's rights and African-American women's rights, because, you know, the court has a bit of a moderate reputation because, you know, once in a great while, they deliver an important moderate or progressive ruling, like the gay rights rulings over the last generation that have really, I mean, you know, as a gay person, those rulings are really, really important to me. But on average, when you look overall at the span of the court's rulings, they have spent the last generation going after everyday Americans, which means women. It means people of color. It means workers. And always, always, always at the behest of the GOP and plutocrats and corporations. And so part of the reason why this country is so hard on everyday Americans is because of the stolen Supreme Court. And yes, you're right. It's not just the Supreme Court, but it's lower courts too. Barack Obama was blocked from filling 119 lower court openings in his last 2 years in office. And then Trump came in and rushed to fill all those seats. Well, those lower court judges are the ones who decide the vast majority of cases. So yeah, if we're going to get a free and fair democracy back, if we're going to address gun violence, climate catastrophe, broken immigration system, reproductive justice, all the issues that need to be addressed, we have to change federal courts. That is the only option.
Yeah, and again, we're talking to Aaron Belkin, and I really strongly suggest you go to their website, Take Back the Court, because there is just some wonderful, wonderful information. And you know that I'm going back that unfortunately in this country we don't tend to really seem to want to know our history. Somehow we love to believe that we are the best possible only democracy, and we're so proud of that. And somehow we don't have a sense that really, who is government going to serve? Are they going to serve the people? And as you say, you know, a society changes. And so I'm thinking, you know, of discrimination. And right now, the real hammer, you might say, is being put on the nail of gender identity. And, you know, and it's things like sexual assault in schools. And I'm thinking of Amy Barrett. And I'm thinking, you know, like I was going through some statistics last night. And I was horrified. And I cover this a lot on the show, that 56 66% of young girls, grades 7 to 12, you know, essentially middle school to high school, suffer some kind of sexual assault or harassment, you know, in schools. And yet Amy Barrett says, you know, that just the fact that it is being studied shows that, you know, young men are being discriminated against. And you think, Where did they find this woman? And it is kind of, you know, that they're the American people. A society evolves, it changes. You know, you get a lot of immigrants, you become far less white. And there you've got this cornerstone that is preventing the reflection of people. And I think our society, frankly, is going to wither, and we're going to lose it totally, our democracy.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a professor, so I have a salary and I'm fine. And I think for the, you know, the 10% or so of Americans whose jobs are stable and who, you know, who thrive in this economy, like, it's a great country. And of course, we should be proud of the progress under American democracy. And American democracy historically has done incredible things for people around the world. But there's a parallel truth about America that is hidden in plain sight because our leaders never tell us the truth about the underside of America. And the underside of America is that we unnecessarily make things incredibly hard on most of our people. It's not just that we're losing our democracy, it's that life is already terrible for most of our people, much worse than if they lived in Canada or Denmark or France. Not to say that any of those countries are perfect, but you don't have hyper inequality. You don't have tens of millions of people with either no insurance or crappy health insurance. You don't have just completely dilapidated public transportation systems. In other countries around the world, they solve the problems that we do not allow ourselves to solve. And so we are already at a place where, you know, to use President Trump's words, we are, for most people, a shithole country.
Yeah, unfortunately. And to me, I have always looked upon Trump, frankly, as a cherry on the sundae. I really have. I frankly have looked upon the Senate and Mitch McConnell and some of his cohorts there as far more dangerous. And that really, to me, that I suspect that after you have a certain amount of money, that the pleasure must come all in power. And really, it's kind of a perversion that really has troubled me actually for several years doing the women's show, because, you know, there ever since Roe versus Wade, you know, 30 days right afterwards, the fights began. And so, of course, if you say, well, if there's that much discussion, obviously there's a problem, you say, no, it was organized by a very small minority from the get-go, and it's been a knockdown, drag-out battle ever since. And essentially, the ones it most affects are the poorer people and the ones who are worse. The ones right now in this COVID epidemic that are considered the essential workers, so they have to put their lives in the line.
There's a very close relationship, I would argue, between white minority rule and white supremacy and patriarchy, hyper-masculinity, and racism. These things all go together, and militarism, they all go together to benefit the elites, to benefit, you know, the Koch brothers, or I guess the Koch brother at this point. And I couldn't agree with you more. And in a sense, I would actually argue, and this sounds a little counterintuitive, I would argue that in a way Trump is a gift, because Trump is not the cause of our problems. He is the result of our problems. And we have a system in which, yeah, Trump might lose the next election, but Trumpism is not going away. And Trumpism is about a very tight relationship that you can see operating over the last generation, the relationship between rich corporations and plutocrats like the Koch brothers on the one hand, Fox News and the right-wing media bubble on the other hand, and the 43% of resentment voters who thrive on this stuff, who all they want to do is scapegoat a different target every election, whether it's a caravan of migrants or transgender people in the bathroom or uppity women like Hillary or black criminals, whatever it is. It's these people who vote on the basis of the politics of paranoia. That ironclad triangle between those three forces, plutocrats, Fox News, and resentment voters, that's not going away. And that radical triangle is why we have a Republican Party that's so radical. All they know how to do is lie, because the things they believe in are unpopular. And it's that system that sustains Trump. So even if Trump goes away, Trumpism is going to be here unless we structurally reform the society. We have to unrig our democracy to defang that triangle.
I couldn't agree more. Here we're talking to Aaron Belkin. I guess I'm thinking historically, that as I understand it, only about 5 to 15% max of the people in this country actually supported the American Revolution. And I think that, because I know when people are going to hear this, they're going to say, you can't really think we should pack the court. And I'd say, no, the court's already packed. You can't put in any more sardines. The only way you can do it is to get a bigger hand. I don't mean to be frivolous, but we have this sense of that old radicalism that you can't do stuff like that. It has to be done slowly and incrementally. Yet you know in science that elements don't just all of a sudden incrementally go, that they leap. They make a leap. An electron makes a leap. And I guess I have to hope that there are that 5 to 15% of the population that will say, absolutely, I get it, that if we want to save this country, we actually have to try democracy and see if it works.
Well, the Republicans already packed and stole the courts. They stole lower federal courts, 119 lower court openings that Barack Obama was supposed to fill, but Mitch McConnell wouldn't let him fill. They stole the Supreme Court in 2016 by blocking Merrick Garland. They're stealing the Supreme Court again by rushing through an appointment while people are already voting. And federal courts, it's just like the Senate and the House and the White House, where, most of the justices on the Supreme Court at this point were picked by presidents who lost the popular vote. Even if Democrats win the popular vote overall in House and Senate races, they often lose control of the House and Senate because of the way the system is set up. Same thing with the presidency, the Electoral College, where, Democrats win the popular vote but lose the presidency. And we've gotten to a place where a white nationalist minority that's a shrinking minority controls the levers of power. And the only way to unrig the system so that that type of thing is not possible is to sweep back into power to win the election. But then if we're going to get anything done, we have to unrig the system. And that means changing Senate rules, kill the filibuster. It means passing an aggressive democracy bill like H.R. 1 to ban gerrymandering, ban voter suppression, ban dark money, things like that. But if you just do that, John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh are going to rip up those reforms. And so the third step that you have to do, in addition to killing the filibuster and passing a democracy bill, is expand the court, because otherwise those democracy reforms will not stand. So court reform has to go along with democracy reform.
Well, Aaron Belkin, I know how busy your schedule is right now, and I know you have another commitment, but I would love to bring you back because I really feel that this is, that at first it sounds shocking. I think I know it will sound shocking to a lot of people. And to me, it tells an awful lot about us that it does. But I would love to bring you back so we could even go in a little more detail, because I think it is so important that we understand more about this. So again, we've been talking to Aaron Belkin. Take back the court. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so very much.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. And Arlene, Aaron Belkin tells it like it is.
And he did, and I want to remind everyone, it is very important that you vote. I'm assuming that you're registered, and every person who is registered to vote should be out there voting, whether it's by mail, early voting, or on November 3rd. If you're voting by mail, be sure you follow every instruction. Sign where you're asked to sign, including the inside envelope. Remember, in Florida, you must use both envelopes. Any step not done will cause your ballot to be cast away. So be careful, but vote.
Absolutely. Follow the, read them carefully. Follow them absolutely to the T. And you can actually check also to make sure if it's your absentee ballot, and you can follow up on that. But it's never been more critical, people. Democracy is demanding us to act, and it's pretty exciting, really. It might be formidable, but hey, I'm Irish, so things are, you might feel a bit helpless, but it's never hopeless. So, okay, well, Davey's got to win some, so let's put this on before the news. Thanks so much for listening. WMNF Tampa.
Was a giant. It was smaller, much by far, but not quite microscopic. His name was Davy, the short one. The big guy was Goliath. I don't read the Bible. much. In fact, it's more like never. But I still think it's really cool that Davy kicked his butt. Sometimes Davy wins. 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 The real estate executive called into the home office. What a place, what a really great place. Eureka, we struck gold. All the people gathered round, they yelled, you gotta go, son. We do not need your Wally World. In fact, we can be no fun.